You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
Alan Hendricks and his brother Randy have been in the business of representing professional athletes for nearly 50 years. Originally representing pro football players, they switched to baseball early on, and they have represented some of the best-known players in the sport. In full disclosure, I already know most of the answers to these questions because Alan is my uncle, his sister is my mom, and today is her birthday. Happy birthday, Mom. He and his brothers are a big reason I got involved in sports. Their interest in sports rubbed off on me very early in my life. Most of my favorite memories through the years came because of my relationship with Alan and the Hendricks brothers. They are considered among the white hats in the agent business by baseball executives like Allard Bear, Dave Dombrowski, and Dayton Moore. Alan, welcome to Sports Connections.
How you doing, David?
I am doing great. It's a pleasure to chat with you in an official capacity rather than just family stuff. So.
Yeah, I'll try to keep it professional.
All right. To start with, how and why you guys got involved in the agent business?
Well, somewhat similar to you talking about how you got involved with sports. It started off with we just love sports. But a whole lot of people love sports. That's why 25% of the newspapers in America devote their coverage to sports. But then it gets what you have to realize that sports is really a business at the professional level. And early on, we got involved because we wanted to, but we brought some professional capabilities to it and always utilized it that way. And one of the reasons that some of those executives who you mentioned, all of whom I consider friends, even though they were professional adversaries, they appreciated the fact that we were not on a crusade. We never made it personal. We simply, we had a job to do. And the job to figure out was, how do we assign the appropriate value to any particular player in the sport? After that, there was a community of interest. Our goal was for the player to outperform the contract every time, because it meant we got to come back and get even more next time. So those guys always liked the business-like and professional approach, where our job, because we had many times talking with various executives, a player may have had a problem off the field, a traffic ticket, marital problems, you name it, just stuff that interferes with one's ability to focus and concentrate. And we would work with the team many times just to get things back so that the player could perform as well as possible. So we got in, like I say, we got into the business because we loved it. But Randy's a lawyer. I have a finance background. We brought the financial industry and the legal industry's capabilities into something that before had just been kind of a mom and pop show.
Yeah.
And people just kind of deal on an emotional level or from a fan's level. And one of the things about fans, I don't want to insult anyone listening, but the old story about fans is Bobby Knight had a great quote. If I listened to the fans, I'd soon be sitting up there with them.
Yeah, so
therefore, none of us really could afford to worry about the fans. It would be, as I sit here now, retired from the agent business, and I sit here and watch James Harden want to leave the Rockets or Watson want to leave the Texans. As a fan, I might think, shoot, that's no good. Those guys are great players. But when I was in the business, if a player left Kansas City to go to Boston or Boston to go to New York or you name it, from one, you know, you just got to do what's right. But more importantly, it's what that player really wants to do, to choose where they will feel the best or have their talents exploited the best, or to play for a certain coach or manager. So there was a lot of those things that took place, but we always approached it from a perspective that We're professionals and we're businessmen, and these guys are professionals and they're businessmen. Now we just got to agree on assigning a value. It's no different than trading on a piece of a property or buying a stock or whatever.
And one of the things that I've always heard about you guys is that you would only represent clients that would allow you to help them manage their assets. Basically, you were not just negotiating their contract. You wanted to be involved in their life. You didn't want them to blow their money. Why did you have that approach?
Well, that was a big part of it, because part of the impetus to make us think we could do better was reading about iconic players of the era like Mickey Mantle, Jerry Lucas in basketball, Lance Allworth in football. You'd read stories about how those guys had made a few bucks, which seem microscopic by today's standards, yeah, but big at the time. And those guys would invest in things that just didn't make any sense. It's like they got hustled into something because it just sounded good with no business, no good business plan. And those guys would go from making a bunch of money to needing to work to make, yeah, a living. So we thought we could do better. We did not manage players' monies as much as we encouraged them to get proper managers or to manage it themselves, because we always figured within this is true in real life too, not just ball players. If either the wife or the husband are savers, one of them can be a spender and they're still going to be okay. The problem, yeah, would always be when you had both a wife and a husband just wanting to live large all the time, and pretty soon the music stops. So we would go seek players who were receptive to that pitch. So, because a lot of guys that were thinking, hey man, I'm thinking about is a house for my mother and a big car for me and taking the family on trips to Hawaii all the time. Those guys weren't real responsive to our pitch anyway. So yeah, it was kind of a self-selective process. We looked for guys that wanted to approach things the way we like to approach them. So there was a good compatibility.
Okay. As I mentioned in the introduction, you guys started with football. I've already had Elmo Wright as a guest. I know he was your first client. Talk about the switch from baseball to football.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Elmo was the firstborn, and now he's in the Hall of Fame, which is great. And our second client was his good buddy, Robert Newhouse, who was a really good running back for the Dallas Cowboys for years. And then we had a handful of other players that typically smart offensive linemen who then became lawyers and doctors, et cetera. It's kind of interesting on that perspective. But we had an opportunity to be in Cleveland, Ohio with an investment firm, and we were giving a talk on just good management and real estate opportunities in Texas. And in the audience were two members of the Cleveland Indians baseball team who thought they liked what Randy and I were saying. And it was at the time when the ruling was made within baseball that Marvin Miller had prevailed in an arbitration case. So the owners were going to have to start treating the players in a business style, which created arbitration, free agency, and everything we know today. Because in the past, there was a reserve system, which meant that after each year, the club reserved the right to bring you back next year, and you couldn't go anywhere. So it was a form of servitude.
Right.
I don't want to get too carried away, but you know, players had no rights to go anywhere unless they were traded or released.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they had no call on where they went. So Marvin created this new system, and these guys on the Indians thinking, you guys seem like smart guys and you're already in sports, we bet you can adapt and function in this. And quite frankly, Randy and I always liked baseball better than football as far as participating and watching. And so it just seemed like a natural thing. And as we got into it for about a 3 or 4 year period, we tried to keep doing football and baseball. But as I've told many people over the years, it gradually, because it's such two different systems, two,
yeah,
different seasons, two different calendars, it was like somebody who's a doctor trying to be both an obstetrician and an orthopedic surgeon all at once. You got to make your choice. So we just opted into baseball because the system was better, the money was bigger. Quite frankly, there were more players receptive to what we were pitching. As a matter of fact, baseball players, after 5 years in the minor leagues, were eager as heck to hear about, yeah, I can make some money, and you're going to help me learn how to keep it? Count me in.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I've heard the statistics that, and I don't know if it's my numbers are exactly correct, but more than half of all professional athletes file for bankruptcy within 10 years of retirement.
I don't, David, really know whether that's accurate or not, but it's way too healthy a percentage.
Yeah.
First of all, because their careers are short. You know, they in football, they're lucky if they last 4 years, just because the injury factor and the wear and tear factor. And a lot of times guys get so geeked up about spending money early, by the time they're ready to start saving it, the train stops. And so it happens. So I wouldn't be surprised on that. All I can tell you is that I don't have any knowledge of anyone we ever dealt with in any kind of capacity that needed to file bankruptcy. Some of them got short on money, and, you know, we just have to encourage them as much as we can to get a new financial manager, or, you know, just do whatever it took to try to preserve it. And lots of our old clients are living very, very nicely these days because they were smart with their how they spent and how they invested.
And that leads to an obvious follow-up question, Alan, and is that how did you know, you say you don't know of any of your former clients, and you've had hundreds that had to file bankruptcy, and yet we've talked about those percentages. What did you guys do? How did you keep that from happening to your clients?
Well, we didn't. We first of all, we pre-selected. So if you get guys who are predisposed not to do stupid things, that helps. So therefore, therefore, we're skewing the sample pretty badly there.
Yeah.
And we would also try to get guys that had a predictability of a long career. And, you know, so there are certainly some guys that were on the precipice that were in financial troubles because they did get carried away. And I'm not going to go into in depth any of that because right. Not every story was a perfect one, but the majority were, a huge percentage in majority were. And we just encouraged the things that any rational person would encourage anyone who's working with you to do.
Yeah.
Live within your means, make smart investments. You don't need to listen to somebody's harebrained scheme about how you're going to get rich quick on a silver deal in Mexico, say, even though we're not dealing with any mining engineers. I don't want to get too far afield with examples, but oftentimes somebody might have a good idea, but if you don't know how to execute it and do the game plan, what difference does it make if you have a good idea? Somebody else that knows how to execute will come up with that idea and ultimately make it work.
Yeah.
So therefore, there have been some home runs, some monster home runs done in investments by some of our clients because they got involved with the right people. But we would always encourage them, pre-select who you're dealing with and make them stand the test of time and show their track record and then listen to them.
Yeah.
And don't think you're supposed to make it all in 1 year or one time because it doesn't work that way. It's over a period of time.
Okay. We've talked about some of your successes away from the not the X's and O's of baseball, but away from the game itself. I want to talk to you about something that you guys have been very successful at. You rarely lost arbitration cases. How were you so successful? And we were talking earlier, you gave me the statistics. I'd love for you to share those and just talk about how you were successful.
Well, we had over 20 cases and we won 2/3 of them. I believe the actual number is 14-7. And we're supposed to be deal makers. So therefore I considered us going to arbitration was because there wasn't a deal to be made. And that's the vehicle, how you resolve it. So you do it. And if you're going to do it, you do it right. And the preparation, my brother Randy was just absolutely maniacal on preparation. He would even get irritable at me if we settled a case, even if he understood it was a good settlement, because he'd already prepared such a good case and he knew he was going to go win it. Which is okay, you know, and I'd have to soothe him and say, listen, I appreciate it. But it was because of that fierce preparation and ability to speak in the arbitration room. And most importantly, where Randy really, really shined was in rebuttal. And that helped. And another thing that we had, we ended up hiring, the two of us thought, we'd read enough stuff from this obscure young guy in Lawrence, Kansas named Bill James. We hired Bill to help us with arbitration cases.
Wow.
For a few years. And Bill, who, of course, is the father of sabermetrics these days.
Yeah.
And has worked for ball clubs. But early on, Bill worked for us. And we'd pay him a stipend, which doesn't seem like much these days. And it wasn't. But to him, it was big money and he could use it. And so he was a very useful part of the cases because he knew how to dig out numbers that the teams didn't even know existed until they finally bought into it. And then you start having Moneyball and all the stuff with Bill working for the Royals and you have him working for the Red Sox. And now every team embraces the stuff Bill did. So we were way ahead of the curve on that. And that was useful because a lot of times, sometimes these outside lawyers that a club would bring in or their team general counsel, they'd have a look on their face of like they'd been ambushed in an old Western movie.
Yeah.
Because it was like, you know, I think that may be right. And we didn't even, not only weren't prepared for it, we didn't even think about it.
Yeah.
Then the arbitrator sits there and it's almost like, you lose. And so a lot of times we got great settlements because teams knew that if they were going to go against us, there was a big chance they might get beat. There were other agents, they couldn't wait to go get in the room and beat them up because they knew they'd be outgunned. They could outgun them.
Yeah.
So, you know, part of it was that we just prepared like mad and took it serious. I used to hate January and February because all we did was work late hours every night preparing these cases. And then that was January. And then February it was arguing them. Yeah. So when they got done on February the 20th, I'm thinking, good, spring training's in 10 days, warm weather, no pressure, no stress. It was almost like a vacation. It wasn't because we were working, but
Right. Relatively
speaking. Now arbitration has become less and less of an exercise because everyone's looking at the same stuff. We were just well ahead of it. And as I'm talking 35, 40, 42 years ago, we're doing all this stuff that has been commonplace for the last 15 years, say.
Yeah. I'll switch gears again. It probably won't come as any surprise to you that I'm very proud to be your nephew and, you know, all five of the Hendricks brothers, shall we say. One of my favorite stories to share is how in the first Gulf War, you took some of your clients on a tour visiting the troops in the Middle East with General Richard Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Let's talk about how that came about and then that trip itself.
Well, Dick was a high school classmate of mine. And as a matter of fact, we played together on a church league basketball team for Countryside Christian Church in near Mission on Overland Park. And we were the two forwards. And my memory may be wrong, but I think we won the county championship, and if not, we did it in our minds. But anyway, Dick and I were buddies, and then he went off to K-State. I came down to Houston to go to the U of H, and we'd see each other every 10 years at a reunion, maybe. But at our 40th reunion, he had been elected as the vice chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff the year before, appointed by President Clinton, and he was watching me. We were standing in the back for a group picture of the class, and I had one of these little prehistoric battery-powered TV sets, and I'm watching my client Roger Clemens punch out about 19 guys in a playoff game against Seattle, and so he's wondering about that, so I filled him in on what I'd been doing, and he just started thinking what I did was the coolest thing in the world. Because he loves sports, like, again, so many people do. He loves the Chiefs and the Royals, for example, still. He's currently the president at K-State. And anyway, so Dick thought what I did was cool. And, of course, I'm thinking, what are you talking about, man? You're the head military guy for the planet. I think what you do is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then 9/11 happened, which was awful, and the Yankees were playing – the Arizona Diamondbacks in the World Series that year, and I had this bright idea to have the Yankees get together a signed jersey by every player on the Yankees, Jeter and Roger and everybody, Tino, you name it, and send it to Myers at the Pentagon. And it got there, and it sat in their room where they're checking out to see if anthrax has been sent to the Pentagon.
Yeah.
For about 30 days, and I finally called up Dick's public affairs officer and saying, "What gives here? Didn't you get that present I sent to him?" And he went and found it in the room, and then they got it, and everyone thought it was the coolest thing ever. And so early the next spring, when the Yankees opened the season in Baltimore, Roger and I chartered a bus and took several of the players to the Pentagon, Bernie Williams, Andy Pettit, a couple, three others, Torrey went, Don Zimmer, the coach, and we went and had a tour of the Pentagon and it was while the reconstruction was going on after the plane hit the building. So we saw all of that. And of course, as we were walking around the corridors of the Pentagon, people were pouring out the doors, and it was something. The players loved every bit of it because they were getting all this love and fondness from the quote fans there at the Pentagon. And they're feeling proud because they're helping boost patriotic fervor, which is all good. I'm sure you remember how it was back in that time.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone's flying a flag and everyone's proud of the country. So we did that. And so the public affairs officer, T. McCrary, came up with the idea then that he wanted to know if Roger and I would go with him and Dick and the comedian Drew Carey. I think he's a game show host these days.
Yeah.
And a couple other well-known people on a tour of the Middle East. So we, the players went to the Pentagon, but only Roger and I went to the Middle East. That was for a 4.5-day period right before Christmas in 02. And it was an experience because we were in that period of time, we're in Qatar, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Kuwait, Ireland, and back home in 4.5 days. And I think I might have slept 20 hours total, including on the plane. So anyway, that was quite an experience. And then the next year, I was nominated by Dick to go. Matter of fact, he got to appoint two guys to get to go that didn't have to qualify for what's called the Joint Civilian Orientation Conference, where 40 civilians that are high achievers around the country get to go see the military facilities. And the whole idea of the Department of Defense was, and I'm sure it's still going on, was that these influential people had come back and publicized what a great job the U.S. military is doing.
Yeah.
And it was great. And Dick got to appoint two guys that just got to go because he said so. I called them the coaches admit that the prestigious Ivy League school. And those two guys were me and Lamar Hunt.
Wow.
So we did that. And that was a very cool experience. And so then that trip culminated. We're back in the States and Dick and I then fly up to New York and he throws out the first pitch at Yankee Stadium on Flag Day with the Cardinals playing. So it was a wonderful experience. So, and Dick and I still keep in touch and we're still waiting for the time that K-State has taken on the Cougars, but that hasn't happened yet. But we always tell the other when we pull for your team, except if we ever get a chance to play each other. So maybe that'll happen one day.
Yeah, I've gotten to know. I don't know whether to call him General Myers or President Myers or whatever, but we always say hi to each other when I'm out covering K-State games. He's a great guy.
He told me when I called him General, he told me I'm Mr. Myers these days. But you know, I'd call him General when his people were around him during his Pentagon days. But other than that, We evolved back to high school days when I'd call him either Dick or some other name that I shouldn't say on your show. We just start giving each other grief because, you know, we could digress back to being 17 and stupid.
Yeah, I hear you. Now, you just shared some really amazing stories that have come about largely because of your career. But you told me a long time ago that your business is not all bells and whistles. What was the most challenging part of your job? And then follow that up with what was the most rewarding?
Well, the challenging part, aside from the enormous preparation and work going into arbitration, which was a big deal because we'd built our reputation on that. And David, sometimes it's harder to keep a reputation than to get one. So we were hell-bent to make sure every year was great. So we did that. But then as the business got more and more attractive to people and the money kept getting bigger, a whole lot of people decide they want to get in the business. And of course, when you're making sales pitches, the old story is anyone can say anything. They just, how do you prove it? I'll do the best job for you of anybody, says Agent X. Well, how do you prove that until they do it? And they either fail or they don't fail.
Yeah.
So probably the toughest part of it was getting, when you're recruiting for the highest level prospects out of college or high school for the draft, was competing with the various forms of puffery done by your competitors and how much the parents bought into it. Because anytime you were recruiting a good player, you had to make three sales. You had to sell the player, of course, that he would want to affiliate with you for the next 5, 10, 15 years. But you had to make sure dear old dad had Sonny Boy's best interests at heart and you knew what you were doing. And lastly, you had to make sure mom was on board because, you know, to her, it didn't matter if her son is 6'5", 230 and throws 98. She's thinking, this is my little guy. You'd better take care of him. So you have to make them all happy. And you know, that was to be those. But the rewarding part was when you made the sale, you think, good, I really wanted this kid. And we got him because we approached it right. But again, it's shared values. Most of the people that came on board, mom and dad wanted to hear, get a lot of money, but keep a lot of money.
Yeah.
And the kid is thinking about, I like flying with the Eagles. The Hendrixes have a lot of stars, and I want to be amongst them. And there's some of our competitors had great stables of players, too, and they had success.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of people just coming in and saying anything that didn't have any level, didn't have a history of success, didn't particularly have any real good players, but they could say and do anything, and a lot of people are susceptible to that because they were hearing what they wanted to hear.
Yeah.
I'm kind of babbling on about that, but I don't miss any of that, David. I can assure you, flying around the country to finish second was crummy feeling.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure.
I'd rather had somebody hang up on me than do all the work to come in second.
Yeah, I'm sure. I want to talk to you about one of your former clients, and obviously you grew up in Kansas City, and I'm still in Kansas City. So people around here know that former Royals manager Ned Yost could be somewhat cantankerous. As a member of the local media, I had the occasional turn at getting, as we call it here, getting Yosted. One time you and I were sitting in my mom's living room and Ned called you and you showed me your phone as you were talking to him. And I don't remember how you had his name worded, but I could see that you were talking to him. So next time I was at the stadium, I finally got his attention, which was sometimes hard. But I said, we have a friendship, I think is how I worded it. He said, oh, really? Who's that? I said, Alan Hendricks. He just completely changed his countenance. All of a sudden, I was his best buddy. Now, the funny thing is, I still got Yosted at times, but he and I became friends away from the pregame presser in the dugout and away from the times when he would argue that somebody would say, the sky's beautiful day out there, beautiful blue sky. And he'd say, no, it's not. It's a beautiful blue sky. So just yeah. talk about Ned Yost and your relationship with him.
Ned was the backup catcher on the Milwaukee Brewers, and I guess it's not all that bad to be the backup catcher to a future Hall of Famer in Ted Simmons. But you know, Ned was a qualified big league catcher and played for several teams for about a dozen years in the big leagues. Not very often the starter, because he was not a terrific hitter, but he was a first-rate receiver and could throw. And so he was a good player and had a great personality. So people liked Ned quite a bit. And he was on those Brewers teams that were quite good, made the World Series. So
Harvey's Wallbangers.
Yeah, Harvey's Wallbanger with, you know, Robin Yount and Molly and real good pitching staff with McClure and Vuki and Larry Sorensen and Moose Toss. I mean, they had a team. And Eddie Romero, whose son is now a big shot with the Boston Red Sox. Eddie was a utility infielder. Their backup players were good big league players. They were not just some guy warm on the bench. But anyway, Ned was part of that, and I had a handful of players on the Brewers and got along great with Harry Dalton, who was one of the first executives. I kidded him one time. I said, Harry, people get jealous because you treat me so well here when I'm up here. He said, I should always show you the courtesy of the stadium because I think it will be beneficial to me later on when we're negotiating for a player. And he was entirely correct. It's called enlightened self-interest.
Yeah.
Instead of treating me like I'm a pariah for being in the ballpark, I was like an honored guest, and I loved it. I spent time sitting with him and Bud a lot of times. Bud was a little more reserved than Harry, but it worked out great. So I'm thinking back about Brewers days. So now Ned's career has come and gone, and he's now coaching for the Atlanta Braves and being mentored by Bobby Cox, one of the all-time greatest managers and great guy. Coxie was just great. As a matter of fact, Bobby was so smart, he would hire the best coaches possible, and then he would be like General Myers. He'd make the decisions, but everyone else was doing all the work. For instance, spring training, the Braves would have the best spring training of anybody. And who's doing it? Ned's running everything from morning, noon till night on assignments, who's going to throw which bullpen, how are we going to do this? What do you, all Coxie had to say is, that looks good to me, Nedley. Let's go. So anyway, if we're flashing forward, he's been the coach with the Braves for a number of years, and the Brewers have an opening, and I forget who got fired that time, but Doug Melvin was the general manager of the team, and Melvin and I had a good relationship, and I'm talking to him about who you're going to hire, and this is on the heels of Deborah Yost telling me, Alan, will you help push Ned? He will not push himself. He wants to be a manager, but he really is not comfortable pushing himself. He likes other people to come to him. So I said, well, Deb, I know something about how to do all that. So I'm talking to Melvin, and he's telling me who he's thinking about and rattles off three or four names. And I listen, and I said, those guys are all worthy of interviews, but have you considered Ned Yost? No, tell me about him. So I tell him all the things that I just told you about, all the things Ned done. He said, I think I need to talk to him. And I said, good idea. Here's his cell phone number. So Ned calls me up a day or two later and says, hey, I got a call from the Brewers. They're going to give me an interview. What do I say and do? And I said, be yourself, man.
Yeah.
So now I remember Jane and I and my kids were, this was many years ago. The kids were young and were listening to me at the time. So anyway, we're out in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and returning our rent car to Albuquerque, and I'm listening to ESPN radio, and I'm hearing that Doug Melvin is now introducing the new manager of the Milwaukee Brewers, Ned Yost. So I'm thinking, hallelujah, isn't that great? I've been out here out of cell phone coverage, and Ned got the job. Awesome. And so then the best part for me was when somebody's asking Melvin, Yost kind of came out of the blue. None of us had his name. How did you come to do this? And he tells a few things why he did it. And then he says, and really it all started one day when I'm talking to Alan Hendricks on the phone, and he told me I was an idiot if I hadn't interviewed Ned Yost. So I decided to do it, then, and I hired him. So that is why Mr. Yost returned my phone call when my purpose was, I'm coming out to the ballpark tomorrow. It's when you were sitting there in the living room, David.
Yeah.
I'm coming out to the ballpark tomorrow with my two sons and my two grandsons, and I want you to be the best Yosty you know how to be.
Yeah.
And bring George over when you come over so the kids can be impressed. So he did it. And you mentioned Dayton Moore earlier. Dayton and his secretary loved it. They liked seeing that. They might not want to do me too many favors, but you know what? If you do something for somebody's sons and grandsons, that's 100 times better than doing it for me.
Yeah. How do you think, Alan, how do you think Ned will do, and I know we're running close on time here, how do you think Ned will do as a member of the media? He loves the media so much.
I don't know. Is that what he's doing now?
Well, it was just announced earlier this week that he is going to be a commentator for MLB Network Radio.
Okay, well, Ned's smart. He's going to have good pearls of wisdom.
Yeah.
I've got lots of guys that have retired that are on MLB Network. One of my favorites is Al Leiter, who was a wonderful client to represent. Yeah. And Al is smart as can be and funny. I remember one time, though, he and I were having lunch in New York, and he said, looks at me with his Jersey accent and says, Alan, you know why most people don't like you or me? And I said, Al, I thought they did like us. So tell me, why don't they like us? He says, we say what other people are thinking. Well, he's taken that to the booth,
and
it's great. People love to hear what he's got to say. And now he's having the ultimate. You talk about kids. His son is maybe the best pitcher in college ball right now.
Yeah, so, probably number one pick.
Yeah, who knows? And, you know, and I can remember, I haven't seen Jack in a few years, but the first time I saw him, he and Al were out in a park in front of the Vinoy Hotel in St. Petersburg, Florida. Yeah, Al was playing out the string with the Yankees, and Jack was about a two-year-old little guy with a plastic wiffle ball, bat and ball, and whacking away at him, and Al's pitching and having the time of his life. And that was our business meeting. Talking business while playing wiffle ball with a little two-year-old kid who turned out to be Jack Leiter.
Wow.
So, you know, you're making me think about old memories, which are fun and fond. I remember that as if it had happened a couple months ago.
I know it's like asking if you have a favorite kid, and in your case with Jason and Sam, you only have to choose between two, but do you have a favorite client?
Well, there were plenty of them. There were lots of guys. I mean, Donnie Robinson, who was a great pitcher for the Pirates and later on Donnie was an incredible athlete. He played for Pittsburgh, hurts his arm, and there's question whether he'll ever be able to pitch in the big leagues again. So he goes to the instructional league in Florida, and Lee, except for one hit, almost wins the Triple Crown as a hitter while he is a major league pitcher. He led the Florida Instructional League one year in home runs, RBIs, and if he'd gotten one more knock, he'd have won the batting championship. It turned out his arm healed, and he ended up playing a few more years for the Angels and the Phillies. Some of my favorite Donnie things were he'd pinch hit for himself back when he was in National League teams. He'd be coming out of the game, but they'd let him hit. And I can remember more than one time he'd hit a single or a double, and then they'd go pinch run for him. So he basically pinch hit for himself, and he was just one fun, loving, great guy. So Donnie was just a joy to be around because he loved life and he loved being a big league ball player. And Roger, of course, I mean, was great. But there were so many. Chuck Finley. I can remember tons of really good players who were also really good guys, and just it almost didn't feel like you're working when you're in the company of guys who you genuinely like, and it's a mutual admiration society. I would tell them when they'd ask me a million questions about what Randy and I were doing, I said, keep asking. The more you know, the more you'll realize how good we are. Don't just ask me to be like a teenager where you say, well, I'd like to get X amount of money, and then we get it, and then you say, okay, thanks. I want you to know how we went about doing it. How did this investment turn out so well? The more you know, the more you'll have an appreciation for what we're doing for you. Yeah. So those were the guys that were the favorite, the inquisitive ones, the ones that wanted to be businessmen. Charlie Lee, another great pitcher. And I'm naming names that for any of your listeners that are under 30 would say, who are they? All I can tell them is get out the baseball encyclopedia and look them up. They were studs in their day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, obviously you're the middle of the five brothers. So you know what it's like to try and impress your older brothers or to try and have your younger brothers impress you. One of my all-time favorite Roger moments, ironically, was at your mom's funeral. And my brother was there, of course, raised 2 years older than I. And we're just standing there after the funeral in the fellowship hall of the church. And Ray looks over my shoulder and he says, man, that guy looks like Roger Clemens. And I turned around and said, yeah, it's Roger. You want to meet him? And he kind of, his eyes got wide. And I said, yeah, I'll just take you over. I walked over and I said, hey, Roger, how are you doing? He said, I'm pretty good. And I said, I appreciate you being here. I know my uncles appreciate it. He goes, well, yeah, that too. But your grandmother was a really cool lady and I'm here for her. And then I said, well, I want you to meet my brother. And it was one of the few times in my life that Ray just stood there with his mouth open. I got to impress my older brother because I knew Roger Clemens and he knew me. So that was cool. Roger, very intense, obviously. But a great guy. And it was funny because your older brother, David, when we went back to your house after the funeral, my nephew, Ian, was wearing a Mets hat. And this wasn't too long after the Mets Yankees World Series, I guess it's like 2 years, 2.5 years later. And so Roger comes into your house and David's there and he says hi to him. And he's David, not knowing that I had introduced Ray and Ian, he starts to introduce him and he said, yeah, we met at the church. And then, and of course, being David, he says, well, you know, they're Mets fans. And, Ian's favorite player is Mike Piazza. and Roger's like, oh yeah. And he gets real tense and stuff. He goes, oh, that's okay. Right. You know, Mike's a cool guy, but just for a second, he went into Roger, the player mode. And I think Ian still has nightmares about that day.
Yeah. I don't know about the nightmares, but you know, he was more focused and more intense than any player ever. He could, and he dealt with willpower beyond human scope. Beyond anything, his willpower was off the charts. You know, you talk about knowing somebody, I have to throw in one of my own favorite stories about me while you're doing that. Is in the 1987 World Series, Twins and the Cardinals, and I took my older son Jason out of school so we could go up for the weekend games in Minneapolis. And on Monday morning, there's bad weather all over America, so we're stuck in the airport. And at the next gate is the official plane going back to St. Louis. and at our gate is the plane going to Houston. And I'm sitting there thinking I'm going to be in trouble with my wife because I promised Jason we'd be back for third period at this very exclusive school he was going to at the time. And now I'm not going to make it on time. I'm in trouble. But then we look over across the lobby, and leaning against the pillar is Stan Musial.
Oh, my goodness.
And who was my all-time favorite player as a kid growing up. I love Stan the Man. My boys knew all about Dad loves Stan the Man. And I said, Jason, I've met him one time before, but it was just briefly. This is an opportunity I cannot miss. Come with me, because I'm going to introduce you to Stan the Man, with my subliminal idea being, hi, Stan, meet my son Jason. Now let's you and I talk.
Yeah.
So anyway, I go up like the awkward fan to Stan the Man and say, Stan, pardon the intrusion, but I don't know if you know who I am. My name's Alan Hendricks, and I wanted you to meet my son Jason. And he said, Alan, I know who you are. How's your brother Randy doing? You guys do a great job.
Wow.
And then we had a 3 or 4 minute conversation, which took time I think realized he's a great guy being nice to me, but I've intruded enough. So we took our leave and left, and we walked back over to our spot, and Jason looks at me and says, this is a 16 or 17 year old kid with great perception. He looks at me and said, Dad, you should have seen the look on your face when Stan the Man knew who you were. Because I had gone back to being a kid his age or younger, and I'm in front of my deity, and all of a sudden he knew who I was, and that was more acceptance than anything Dombrowski or Dayton or any of these, or George Steinbrenner. I don't care what any of them said. Stan the Man gave me the validation that I wanted because I went back to being a child.
Our mutual friend Bob Kendrick told me one time that baseball, unlike any other sport, this is true, that your favorite player as a child remains your favorite player even as an adult.
Of course. And, you know, speaking about great guys, Bob is just doing a great job at the Negro League Museum. I've had two private tours with him there. My favorite one, I shouldn't say favorite, because the second one was Bob taking the same group of kids, my sons and grandsons, through the Negro League Museum on the next day after we saw Ned out at the ballpark and George Brett. But the first time I went there, it was Roger's wife, me, Bob Kendrick, and Buck O'Neill getting the private tour. And that was just awesome. Buck was unbelievable. What a fun fellow. He just was great. He brought that museum to life. I mean, Bob didn't say much, because how's he going to out-talk Buck O'Neill, who lived it all?
Yeah.
And exactly. Is there with a statue.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm going to wrap up with this. I'd love to talk about our mutual friend, Jim Nance, but we're running out of time. I want to ask you this final question. What advice would you give someone, a young person interested in getting involved in the sports agent business?
Better love sports, like we said to begin with, but you better bring a specific set of professional skills if you want to make it. So I always tell guys, go to law school. Doesn't mean you got to be a lawyer. You just need to understand the law and contract, understand numbers. Just the mere fact that I like sports. If you notice, baseball teams are being taken over by really, really bright guys, a lot of times from elite universities, but their common thread is they love sports, but they're also highly educated and highly intelligent, and that's what's happened. I do want to say something about Nance, because the Cougars are playing Baylor tomorrow. I know this will be played a few days later. And Jim and I go way back with the U of H, so I'm predicting he will call a game that fans will not know how badly he wants the Cougars to win. But that's what he wants.
Yeah.
But he won't let the viewers know. But I predict that his fellow commentators will give him a few nudges just designed to see if they can make him break character.
They already did that, Alan. When they followed the Cougars' win against Oregon State, and he was talking about the fact the winner of this game, Baylor and Arkansas, will play University of Houston, and Raftery's like, oh, do you have a special interest in that, Jim? And they were already needling him, so I'm sure you're...
Yeah, well, you know, they won't let... Raftery is a really funny dude, and Grant Hill is very, very bright, So those guys will have fun, but, you know, they'll still be professional. It'll be fun. And like I say, I've known Jim for 30 some odd years, and we stay in touch.
Yeah.
And so right now, this is a special moment because we go back. I told him about the era of the Big East. This is U of H's sixth Final Four. That's, you know, that's more than K-State, Missouri, Iowa State, Nebraska, Colorado, Oklahoma, you know, I start rattling off combined. They haven't been to as many Final Fours as Houston.
That's right.
So when you come back after twice in the 60s and three times in the 80s, and now all of a sudden 37 years later, they're there. I am at age 78. I feel like I'm a 22-year-old Bula Bula guy again. I can't wait for that game tomorrow.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Alan, it's always fun to talk to you, but to do it officially now and to do it with the podcast has been great. I appreciate your time very much.
All right, kid. Good to talk to you. Tell your mom I said hey.
Yeah, and even though this is airing on her birthday, you saying something to her now doesn't preclude you or prevent you from having to still call her.
Carol, I will call you today as you listen to this today. Happy birthday, sis.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smale. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smale and his work by visiting davidsmalebooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.